Hello, podcast person, and you're a very special person if you're downloading this. Thanks for choosing this podcast. I'm John Hockenberry, host of The Takeaway, a program that's produced by WNYC and Public Radio International. It's The Takeaway. I'm John Hockenberry. I could be speaking of headlines taking place today, but I'm definitely not. A radical act of nationalist terrorism carried out in Sarajevo 100 years ago tomorrow. Serbian gunmen set off a chain reaction that kills the heir of the Habsburg Empire, draws in first the region of Eastern Europe and then Russia, facing off against the newly united Germany in support of Austria. The French throw in with the Russians and the Serbians, and that draws Britain into what was called the Great War. Nobody thought it would be great in the summer of 1914. By the end of that year, there was no adjective that could convey the horror of the Great War, which became World War I after the war in the 1930s, which exceeded it in horror and brutality. More about that later. This hour, lessons, commemorations, still timid commemorations about this conflict no one thought would last and become that unforgettable year of 1914. The energy crisis between Ukraine and Russia right now can't be understood without understanding the World War I context of Eastern Europe. The aspirations of ISIS in Iraq and Syria, also not understandable without knowledge of the maps created in 1918 and afterwards at the end of that Great War of 1914. We join the BBC's Dan Damon now, who is near where preparations are being made for a very different Bosnian memory of these days 100 years ago, and you can hear sounds of music in the background as musicians prepare to commemorate these holy, in a sense, but also brutal moments a century ago. BBC's Dan Damon has found that changeable lens of history everywhere he's gone to look back in this most dramatic space of decades, perhaps in all of world history.
Well, I'm in a place called Andritsgrad. This is a recreation of different buildings from different parts of Balkan history. There's an Ottoman bazaar, there is a Serbian royal palace, there's an Orthodox cathedral here, all made of concrete and stone, all absolutely new. If you know Epcot at Disney, then it looks a bit like that. The reason is that this is a very Serbian place. We're in Republika Srpska, which is that part of Bosnia which is actually there to try and keep hopes of Serbian nationalism alive. And what they are doing here is commemorating away from Sarajevo the shots, of course, that started the First World War, you can say, that sparked the beginning of the war that happened in 1914, were fired in Sarajevo, which is about 100 kilometers, 60 or 70 miles from here. But the Serbs themselves don't want much to do with that commemoration. They are holding their own here. And there's a reason for that, John. I've been speaking to the mayor of Sarajevo, and he says that Bosnian unity is something that both Serb and Croat nationalists are simply not going to allow, even though their leaders signed agreements in Dayton in 1995. What they want to achieve, according to the mayor of Sarajevo, Ivo Komšić, is a breakup of Bosnia, which they could not achieve through force.
You know, and the meaning of the symbols that are still alive and echo today are very much distorted by the lens of history. You spoke with Denis Gratz, who's a center-left politician in Bosnia. I wonder if you'd react to what he said here.
Politicians misuse this emotional aspects of our history to cover their own incompetence in terms of dealing with the real problems of our society, of our country. The whole historical process is observed as we being the victims and we have to defend ourselves. And if you don't elect us as your representatives, you are doomed.
And that is precisely the nationalism that touched off the events of the Great War. Am I mistaken?
You're not mistaken. What historians don't agree on, though, is what Gavrilo Princip, the man who fired the shots, was fighting for. Was he fighting for Serbia? And certainly Serbia gave him the gun. Or was he fighting for all Serbs who were under the control of empires, including the Austro-Hungarian Empire? Or was he fighting for Yugoslavia, for South Slavs? And of course, Yugoslavia, or the Kingdom of Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, as it was first called, was created out of the ashes of the First World War. What's significant, John, is that it's history, it's 100 years ago, but here it feels so alive.
So can we leave our listeners with your experience visiting the mausoleum where the actual conspirators' remains are buried? Even to this day, and you can see the names?
It is. It's a moving place, actually. It's in Sarajevo. It's just up a hillside there, surrounded by graves of Orthodox, of Catholic, and of Muslims too, and lots more graves that were put there during the war, 92 to 95. I went there with the tour guide, Vedran Grebo. This is the place, of course, as you say, where Gavrilo Princip, his name is prominent, and his co-conspirators are buried.
Actually, all the members of Young Bosnia organization died in the prison very quickly after they were sent to prison. Gavrilo Princip died in 1918.
And the inscription, what does that say?
Blago tome kod uvijek živi imao se raštaj roditi. It means something like, the lucky is the one who lives forever. He had reason to be born.
One of the things that Vedran Grebo pointed out on that mausoleum, John, which I think is very much worth remembering, is that actually there's another date on it, not just 1914. The mausoleum was actually completed in 1939, the start here in Europe, at least, of the next war, the consequence of the first, of course. So you can understand why Bosnians here are a little bit reluctant to make much of this anniversary, this centenary, because they're not quite sure that Gavrilo Princip's legacy has been fully spent yet.
A chilling irony, the mausoleum dedicated in 1939. Dan Damon, BBC journalist and host and presenter, thanks so much.
Good talking to you, John. Thanks a lot.
As the BBC's Dan Damon told us, the aftershocks of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand 100 years ago are alive today. Deep themes of history, old empires vanishing, new empires coming into being, technology applied to war with a horror unspeakable. Technology suddenly available to covering war and news events meant that people saw everything. The war that would end all wars quite literally created the maps of the world that would end all peace in the 20th and 21st centuries. Global Post co-founder Charles Sennett has just launched a new series called The 11th Hour, Unlearned Lessons of World War I. His series is all about the boundaries that are under pressure from Crimea to Moldova to Iraq and Syria, all ethnic and political conflicts that ended with no armistice, resolved with no treaty.
Well, the reason we chose The 11th Hour is because we wanted the series to have some urgency, a sense that World War I matters right now. And while I've been reporting this series, you know, I've been out across the Balkans and in Nigeria. We're planning a trip to Iraq, and looking at the way contemporary conflicts are unfolding and really taking shape along the lines that were created by the maps drawn during and in the immediate aftermath of World War I is amazing. I mean, these maps are now being erased. When you see ISIS openly talking about wanting to erase that history, to cross those lines and to create a new map of the Middle East, the Kurds are saying the same thing in a different language and in a much nicer diplomatic way, but they're also saying we're going to reclaim what we think of as Kurdistan with our capital of Kirkuk in northern what is today Iraq. And this is dramatically unfolding not only there, but you can also see this in Nigeria, very much fueling the ideology of Boko Haram is the notion that Western colonialism and its education is blasphemous. I mean, that's what Boko Haram means. Boko, Western colonial education, Haram, blasphemy. So the arrogance of the drawing of the maps 100 years ago on this anniversary of World War I is very much alive and burning in so many of the conflicts we cover every day right now.
And we could talk about North Somalia and South Somalia. We could talk about North Sudan and the brand new nation of South Sudan as being a representation of all of this. The chaos of the Horn of Africa is basically a consequence of the First World War and then the chaos that happened during the Cold War, which was an attempt to maintain these territories in a kind of Cold War deep freeze. And when it all fell apart, we've seen the result for the last 20 years.
That's right. There's an amazing book by Christopher Clark called Sleepwalkers. I think you've talked about it on your show.
Yeah, it's an unbelievable book.
It's an amazing history which tries to make the comparison that we are living in a moment, a historical moment, that is very similar to the days leading up to World War I, in that we have a multipolar world in which there are rising and declining empires, and that creates great uncertainty. And seemingly small events can just erupt into world conflagrations or regional conflagrations. And I think that's the context in which, you know, a lot of people are looking at Iraq, and it's why everyone is so worried, that really does open the possibility of a Sunni-Shia divide opening up into a regional war. And I think this is why what's happening is horrifying if you know the region well, because if those lines come undone, if the maps of the Middle East are going to be redrawn, we are going to see that theme resonate really across all of the Middle East. And I think it's powerful.
And we have to look unflinchingly at the largeness of the history, because it's bigger than the Middle East. I mean, I remember when I was in Kurdistan at the end of the first Gulf War, people talked about Sykes-Picot and how Clemenceau, the French, sold out the Kurds in 1923. And that was the beginning of all of this sort of thing. But you know, you could also see these maps have been rewritten for decades now. If you look in the Congo, in Zaire, you know, the Belgian Empire is gone. And if you're going to think about what vanished that no one imagined ever being able to vanish in World War I, you've got the Austro-Hungarian Empire, which certainly the authors of the time never believed would just vanish overnight. The Ottomans were sort of on their last legs. But the idea that the U.S. will continue like this forever is perhaps the most dubious assumption if we think back to what changed 100 years ago. And it's all this idea of what we think is permanent and what turns out to be, poof, ephemeral, that really that 100 years was all about, and what makes it so scary to look back on today.
That's right. I mean, that is the question that is resonant right now. If you really want to study history, it's that the United States is in a moment where its rhetoric is disconnected from the way we really carry ourselves in the world. We talk about democracy, but did we really stand up for it in the Arab Spring? We talk about these grand issues that inform the narrative of our country, but to the world, we're not living up to them. And I think that that was one of the most convincing arguments that Christopher Clark made in this book, Sleepwalkers, is that empires can decline, and they can decline rapidly. That can create a time of great uncertainty. And I think Clark was right on the money. I think we're living in a moment where there is a lot at play. And, you know, as we've been saying, it's really time to dust off the history books.
Charles Sennett, co-founder of Global Post and heading up the Ground Truth Project based at WGBH, our partner in Boston. Charles, thanks so much.
Thanks, John.
To check out a clip from the 11th hour and related photos, visit thetakeaway.org. The linkage between the crises in Iraq and the more than three-year-old uprising in Syria has raised a whole new specter and a regional crisis seen as growing, with threats multiplying in complex and unpredictable ways. Here's British Foreign Secretary William Hague speaking in Baghdad this week.
They are carrying out the same crimes in Syria, and we believe the Assad regime bears a direct responsibility for creating the conditions in which this terrorism can thrive.
British Foreign Secretary William Hague referring to ISIS and its crimes in both Syria and Iraq. On Thursday, President Obama asked Congress for $500 million to train and arm members of opposition forces in Syria, a continuation of military aid to the Syrian opposition that has been fueled by support from other regional players as well. Joining us now is Ambassador James Jeffrey, who served as U.S. Ambassador to Iraq from 2010 to 2012, and U.S. Ambassador to Turkey from 2008 to 2010. Welcome to the program, Ambassador.
Thank you very much for having me, John.
Now, your diplomacy in Turkey predates the uprising in Syria, which began in 2011. But you've certainly noted over the past several years Turkey's increasing sympathies with Islamist groups inside Syria attempting to destabilize the regime of Bashar al-Assad, yes?
Without any doubt, Turkey's foreign policy is focused on toppling the Assad regime, and they have worked with a large variety of Islamic groups to that end. I wouldn't say they've directly supported ISIS. They've directly supported other groups. ISIS gets its own support from throughout the Middle East.
Commentators in Istanbul this week came sort of out of the closet from everywhere and said the fall of Mosul represents the failure of the Erdogan policy, the policy of the Turkish prime minister in supporting Syria, in the sense that he's now got two problems directly on his border, ISIS in Syria and ISIS in Iraq. What would you make of that claim?
Well, he's got three problems, those two plus the Assad government also on his border. Prime Minister Erdogan had a very ambitious foreign policy in over the last decade. It hasn't worked out. He has bad relations, obviously, with Assad, with the terrorist groups, with the Iraqi central government, with Iran, and, of course, with Israel. And the only group that he's allied with right now is the Kurdistan regional government in the north of Iraq.
Can he just sort of hunker down with the Kurds in the north and pretend that all of his support for Islamist groups in the past will just go away?
No. Turkey is the most stable and strongest international actor in the region, certainly among the majority Muslim population countries. And Turkey has to play a role. It's an ally of the United States, and it can play a role. We just need a different policy.
Does Erdogan's sort of vague idea of an Islamist-sympathized nexus, a political nexus from Lebanon through Syria into Iraq, has this vague idea become a destabilizing military radicalism that he's lost control of on some level?
I wouldn't go quite that far. Remember, it's the Muslim Brothers, be it in Palestine, be it in Egypt, be it in other areas of the Middle East, that Erdogan identifies with. He doesn't identify with the Salafist al-Qaeda element, but he's created room where they have been able to operate, and he has to deal with that now.
Has he discredited himself with other Islamic leaders inside Turkey and particularly outside Turkey who have huge influence, one in particular who's in the state of Pennsylvania right here in the United States?
He doesn't have too many allies right now throughout the Middle East or elsewhere. He is very popular in Turkey. We saw that in the recent local elections, and he's probably going to be elected president in the next few months. There is nobody either inside the Islamic movement or outside at this point that can really challenge him.
So what could Turkey do tomorrow to help this situation?
First of all, coordinate very closely with the United States. Secondly, work with us, as the president just announced, and with the Gulf moderate states to have a consistent and powerful policy of supporting the moderate opposition to Assad that will simultaneously take on, slowly but surely, these ISIL elements, at least in Syria, and then help us with the Maliki government or whoever replaces it to come up with a common position against the radicals that have occupied a big part of Iraq.
Ambassador James Jeffrey served as U.S. Ambassador to Iraq from 2010 to 2012 and U.S. Ambassador to Turkey from 2008 to 2010. Thanks so much for being with us, Ambassador.
Thank you very much, John.
As Ambassador Jeffrey suggests there, perhaps the biggest regional loser in the crisis in Iraq today is Turkey. And that may be an opportunity for a bit of fence mending with a quiet Islamic leader who represents a huge political constituency in Turkey, who directs his movement from a quiet compound in, as I mentioned in passing with the ambassador, of all places, rural Pennsylvania. Fethullah Gulen is his name, and he has built a global network of schools and Muslim political institutions that are a direct challenge to Turkish Prime Minister Recep Erdogan. Who is Fethullah Gulen? Well, he is a champion of Islamist-style governance in the world using a moderate model, very different from the style of the madrasas in Pakistan, or the powerfully ideologically driven government of Iran. Gulen has the potential of being a kingmaker in Turkey, and no one knows that better than Turkish leader Erdogan, who has jailed Gulen's supporters and banned some of his books. Berna Turam is a professor of sociology and international affairs at Northeastern University in Massachusetts. Fethullah Gulen, a man in self-exile here in the United States, has launched a movement, she says, that is unprecedented in scale and influence.
It's very hard to compare the Gülen movement with another social movement across the world because they have formed these very strong global networks all around the world based on their schools and education system. And to our knowledge, there is no such thing yet in the world. And when it comes to the exile situation, well, it's more like a self-exile because when he left Turkey in 1999 and came here, there were several lawsuits against him by the secular republic questioning his loyalties to secularism and the secular state. But he's been acquitted since then. So he's entirely free to go back and he chooses to stay here for different reasons and for obvious reasons. So this has something to do with the geopolitics of Turkey, where United States puts Turkey in the wider world politics. That's why United States is actually hosting this leader of a very moderate Islamist movement.
And when you say a moderate Islamist movement, how would I be able to identify the schools in the Gülen movement, the educational institutions? What distinguishes them?
Well, you won't be able to identify them because there are, to my knowledge, and I haven't counted them, but there are hundreds of them, or at least 100 in the United States. It's not easy to identify them. In most parts of the world, they're known as the Turkish schools. Like I was in Kazakhstan, and the Kazakh people, the locals, knew them as Turkish schools, not Gülen schools. They provide secular education, so you're not going to find Islamists teaching anything. They're very hard to distinguish. One thing is that they all are very competitive science schools. They're very good schools all around the world, and parents like those schools. Here, most of them are charter schools, so they're entirely legit.
And it sounds like they're the opposite of the madrasa movement in places like Pakistan.
Entirely, yes, that's correct. So their main goal has been to raise and educate this new generation of highly competitive, scientifically competitive people.
And Muslims in large part.
In general, no. Americans also go to those schools here.
Well, it does seem, though, that Fethullah Gülen has a vision of bringing whatever he considers to be his people or his followers out of a sort of backward political and economic state. And just like Ataturk's answer to that in Turkey was to create a secular Turkey, and the Shah's answer to that was to create a hyper-modern state in Iran— Gülen has his own particular vision of bringing people out from under a sort of intellectual second-class citizenship. Would you say that's reasonably correct?
Yes, we can say that. But because the movement is so global now and they have schools and missions all around the world, their mission is actually different in different parts of the world. So what they do in Kazakhstan is not going to make any sense in the United States, or what their schools do in Turkey is not going to work in Germany. So one important thing about the Gülen movement is that wherever they go, they engage the states. They follow the states' agendas instead of challenging or confronting them. So here in the United States, I would identify them mostly as interfaith. So they really aim at bringing people from different religions together, and they want to get along with these different religious communities like the Jewish and the Christians. And this became their agenda in the United States after 9/11, and their visibility here became much more important after 9/11.
What is Fethullah Gülen like? Is he a charismatic man, an intelligent man, a gentle man? What's your impression?
He was a very kind and modest person, and he still is, I'm sure. I met him only once. Everybody assumes that he's leading this huge movement. He's the top of a hierarchical movement. It is a hierarchical movement, but really, I mean, most of the day he's sitting in his room in Pennsylvania and contemplating. He's more like a Sufi. The movement is very dispersed and it cannot be controlled from one center anymore. So I would say it's conspiracy theory when people say Gülen is watching the entire business and conduct of the movement. It's by now it's completely impossible because it's all around the world.
Then let's focus on Turkey before we go, Bernat Aram. Would you say that there is a dispute between, or traditionally has been a dispute between Prime Minister Erdogan and Fethullah Gulen?
There is definitely a dispute. There are misleading interpretations of the tension and the dispute between them. It's important to remember that historically, the Gulen movement and where Erdogan comes from have never been eternal friends. So they come from different historical points. They come from different understandings of Islam. Prime Minister Erdogan was always closer to another Islamic leader, Erbakan, who was known as a much more radical Islamist. And Gulen comes from a different perspective, which has always been anti-communist, much more conservative, and definitely less radical. Actually, not radical, anti-radical. He always defended status quo. So they come from different points. But at some point in Turkish history, they actually agreed, they were on the same page, and now they can't get along.
Not only can I not get along, Erdogan has put members of the Gulen movement in prison, people are under house arrest. There seems to be a very tight rein and a suspicion on the part of Erdogan of Gulen's intentions.
That's correct, but Erdogan has been doing that to everybody. I mean, most of the critical voices.
Bernat Aram, thanks so much.
Thank you very much.
Bernat Aram is a professor at Northeastern University, professor of sociology and international affairs. Notorious Boston crime boss, Whitey Bulger, who would kill you as quick as he would look at you, hates the word rat or informant.
What this is all about, quite frankly, is he doesn't mind being called a murderer. He doesn't mind being called a criminal. Obviously, he doesn't mind being called a drug dealer. But he doesn't want to be called an informant because where he came from in Southie, that's the worst thing you can be.
That's Assistant U.S. Attorney Fred Wyshak. If anybody wants to settle a score with Whitey Bulger over him being a rat, he'll have to do it in federal prison. Wyshak was part of the team that convicted Bulger of 31 counts of federal racketeering, including the participation in 11 murders. Bulger was sentenced to 2 consecutive life terms plus 5 years for his crimes. It's hard to separate the man from the legend, gossip from the truth, but in his new film, Whitey USA versus James J. Bulger, director Joe Berlinger tries to tell all sides of the story.
Whitey Bulger is a vicious, brutal killer, but he has a set of rules, a code that he lives by. And a lot of people have considered him, strangely enough, a hero in some ways. So I've never seen a character or a person, you know, particularly a criminal, so pass into the public consciousness and been so mythologized.
Do you think Whitey Bulger believed he had a license to kill? He certainly didn't have any moral qualms about killing, but do you think he had a get-out-of-jail-free card?
I believe Whitey was politically connected. Also, it's undisputed that he was paying off not just people in the FBI, but the Massachusetts State Police, the Boston Police. He had a lot of bad cops in his back pocket. And if he was not an informant, as Bulger alleges, if in fact his name was just being used to soup up affidavits that were being used to bring down the Italian mafia, if he was being protected by the then chief of the New England Organized Crime Strike Task Force, Jeremiah O'Sullivan, if it's true that he had a deal with Jeremiah O'Sullivan, look, I'll protect you from retaliation against the mob if you protect me and keep me from getting indicted, then he really did feel he had a license to kill.
Hmm. Contrast the tone of Bulger in the courtroom with Bulger in the discussions with his attorney that you got exclusive access to.
Yeah. Well, Bulger in the courtroom is a guy who kept his head down, was doodling, looked faint, frail, you know, unremarkably dressed, looked like a little old man actually at times. Never looked the victims in the face, rarely spoke. But when you hear some of the things that we were actually able to record, you hear about his philosophies, his defense, his life of crime. You know, he's a guy with a code and obviously a code that's deeply flawed. But he claims he was never an informant, that he was the guy paying for information, not giving it, that he was not guilty of some of the murders he was charged for, and interestingly, did not deny many of the murders. You know, I think he's a guy who, at the age of 83, knows he's not emerging from those prison walls, and he struck me as somebody who wanted to set the record straight. I think there was much deeper corruption in the FBI and the Department of Justice that enabled this guy to happen, and I think he wants that story out before he goes.
And it's a perversion of the system of justice when you can't really tell the difference between setting the record straight, which is what Bolger is doing here in this conversation, and the actual truth. Listen.
Two of the charges against you, Jim, are that you were involved in the murder of Deborah Hussey and Debbie Davis. Did you have any involvement in those two cases at all?
No way. Those were Stevie's girlfriends. That's his problem. Had nothing to do with me. Nothing.
I am proud that we actually got Bolger in the movie. No one has ever heard from Bolger, despite the dozens of books that have been written. But in no way am I telling the audience that we should believe anything that Bolger is saying as being necessarily truthful. But when you look at some of the underlying facts, you look at that informant file. It's a 700-page informant file, half of which are cover pages. Gregory Scarpa, who was undisputedly an FBI informant, his informant file for the same time period was 50 or 60,000 pages. And there's no in the Bolger informant file, there's really no, an informant file is supposed to be full of unique information that could have only come from the source that leads to a prosecution. And there's no information in those files that is anything but just random, well-known information for which there are duplicative sources, and none of this information ever led to a prosecution. I can't tell you if he wasn't an informant or not, but I can tell you that there's a lot of irregularities that have yet to be adequately explained. And so the film is here to ask, how was it possible? And, at the end of the movie, because it was the end of the trial, when the U.S. attorney from Massachusetts, Carmen Ortiz, stands before the press and says, with the conviction of James Whitey Bolger, this ugly chapter in Boston's history is now over. My point is, how can it be over unless we really know what happened, what enabled Bolger to have that kind of criminal reign?
And what we're left with is this criminal who was a legend, who had extraordinary power, power which law enforcement piggybacked on in some form, in some way. Made careers off of, absolutely. And who had huge influence in the city of Boston, in the crime syndicates all over the United States. And that influence is best depicted in this bit of testimony from Kevin Weeks, who was a former member of the Winter Hill Gang, who describes Whitey Bulger as a mentor.
When I first started working with them, I started out small, and just, beating people up and little by little take baby steps, from gambling, loan shark, and, to extortions and stuff, and doing extortions with Jim Bulger and stuff, and just make a lot of money. But the moment that everything changed for me, the moment my life changed is when I was involved in the first murder. It was a double homicide. So then I knew there was, I was in, there was no getting out. So I decided, if I'm going to do this, I'm going to do it right. I'm going to be the best at it that I can.
The best at it that they can. And there's no way out.
Yeah.
That was true for all of them.
Yeah. Yeah, strangely enough, I enjoyed my conversation with Kevin Weeks because there was, I actually give him close to the final word in the film when he says, look, everybody who tells this story shapes it each in their own way for their own benefit. And until everyone starts telling the truth, we're never going to know the truth. And I think, ironically, truer words were never spoken. And in fact, it's ironic coming from his mouth because one of the great moments in the courtroom and one of the great dramatic moments in the film is when Bulger's defense attorney confronts Weeks, who was Bulger's, right-hand man and now is a government witness against him. Carney, J.W. Carney, one of the two defense attorneys, basically catches him in a lie, and Weeks says, hey, I'm a criminal. I've been lying all my life, which to me is just a great line because the government in this trial has relied upon the testimony of murderers and liars as their star witnesses. If there was ever a Rashomon experience, I think it is the Bolger case.
Joe Berlinger, director of the documentary Whitey, United States of America versus James J. Bulger. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Boy, that's a whopper of a crime story and a story of police work in the city of Boston. We've been looking at police departments around the country. If you missed any of it, check out our series page at thetakeaway.org/series/police. We'll also be featuring some of those stories on the Takeaway Weekender podcast. Download it at the iTunes store. Thanks so much for listening. I'm John Hockenberry. This is The Takeaway.
The Takeaway is supported by Lumosity.com, personalized brain training programs developed by neuroscientists to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving through games. Learn more at Lumosity.com.
The Henry Luce Foundation, for increased understanding of East and Southeast Asia. And the Rockefeller Foundation, whose transportation initiative is promoting equitable and sustainable developments in communities across the country.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Geoffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at the New Yorker. So join us every week on the New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.